Welcome to History's Hotties, the podcast that discusses the sometimes forgotten but influential women in American history, and I am your host, Krista. When I finished the last episode and started to think about what I wanted to do next, I had just gotten a new pair of socks that have Rosie the Riveter on them. I thought my purchase would lead to a natural transition of talking about some group of women from the World War II era. However, as I stared at my resources and tried to narrow down a topic, I just couldn't find one that I thought I could do it right, that I could do right, that I could, you know, really present it correctly. Then I was looking through the books on my bookshelf right before I asked my teenage daughter to dust the shelves, and I saw my copy of To Marry an English Lord. I thought about the fact that many American women went to marry English lords and, of course, save their falling down country estates. But what about those ladies that stayed here in the U.S. but married men of power? I realized then I just don't know that much about the ladies who married sitting American presidents. John Tyler, Woodrow Wilson, and Grover Cleveland all married while they were president. Today, we are going to talk about Frances Folsom, who married Grover Cleveland, the only president to be married in an actual White House ceremony, and she is today's history's hottie. Imagine you are getting married in the White House. There haven't been many weddings in the White House since the Adams family, yep, I said Adams family, moved in. If my research is correct, there have been 17 weddings either inside or on the grounds of the White House. Some of these were children of presidents, but there were also siblings and nieces and nephews of presidents on that list, in addition to old Grover. And I say old Grover because he was quite the ladies' man as far as I'm concerned. Not only was Frances the youngest first lady ever, which also meant she lived longer after leaving the White House than any other first lady, but she was also 28 years younger than the president. Now, this was not the biggest age difference between a president and his bride. That distinction is held by John Tyler and his second wife, Julia, at 30 years. We'll talk about them later. Of course, when there is a wedding, while everyone is looking at the bride, we should probably know a little bit about the groom. If any of you have ever watched the movie 27 Dresses, the one thing that Katherine Heigl says in that movie that I love is talking about how when everyone else stands up and turns around and watches the bride walk down the aisle, she likes to turn around and see the face of the groom. I think that's rather poignant, so thought we would talk about President Cleveland a little. I did some digging to see if Cleveland was ever engaged before Miss Folsom, but I couldn't find an engagement. However, Cleveland did have a well-documented relationship with a widow named Maria Crofts Halpin and continued to support her child after it was born, so we can only assume that this child was his. He did not deny that the child was his. Cleveland was born in 1837 in Caldwell, New Jersey, to Richard and Anne Cleveland. His father was a pastor, but the family sometimes struggled for income. So at one point, Grover, who had actually been called Stephen as a child, had to leave school to enter an apprenticeship. During his pre-presidential career, he was a sheriff, the mayor of Buffalo, the governor of New York, after a stint as a practicing attorney, which he had become after clerking in a law firm until he studied to pass the bar in 1859. So quite the list on his resume. He found a way to become successful in spite of the challenges of his family. He had also spent some of his time before working in the law firm at home working to support his family after his father died. Generally, he was a fairly simple guy. He lived in a boarding house during much of his career as a bachelor. Cleveland was the 22nd and the 24th president, which is a little unusual. He was the only president, in fact, to serve non-consecutive terms. And his first inauguration was in March of 1885. So that gives you a little bit of background about President Cleveland. So let's go now to the lady that stole the heart of a president. Frances Folsom was born in 1864 to attorney Oscar Folsom and his wife Emma. Normally, unless the newlyweds were childhood friends or even childhood sweethearts, we would have a history of experiences before we met. However, as the Clevelands did throughout their lives, here is where they first bucked the trends. Oscar, a fellow attorney, and Grover were close friends, and Grover first met little Frank, named for an uncle, which she then changed to the more feminine Frances later on, when she was but a wee babe. He apparently doted on her. Yep, I know how this is sounding, which we will revisit shortly. But the plot thickens when Oscar dies without a will. The Washington Post says he was driving his carriage recklessly, which seems to be a theme, as a man who was an attorney, but didn't take the time to walk down the hall and ask one of his fellow attorneys to write a will or to plan for the future of his wife and young daughter should something happen to him. I found two different dates in two different reputable sources that say Oscar dies when Frances was 9 and another said 11. However, I think I'm going to go with 1875, which would make Frances 11. In fact, it was 2 days after her 11th birthday. There had been a sister named Nellie, but she died very early on, so when Oscar died, Frances was the only child. A court appointed Grover Cleveland executor to the estate, and there seems to be some evidence that his initial interest was just that Frances not suffer from poverty and struggle for an education like he did. She attended Medina School for Girls and Boys, where she finished her coursework but didn't stay for graduation. She then went to Wells College, in a time where not all young ladies had that kind of educational opportunity, so Cleveland certainly followed through with the intention to make sure his friend's daughter was educated. So here's where the story becomes the stuff of a good gossip rag. There have been reports that when Cleveland was asked as a bachelor politician about, you know, would he get married? Did he love anyone? He said he was waiting for his bride to grow up. And now we get back to the questionable part of the story. So Frances graduated from Wells College in 1885, but there are a couple of different scenarios about how and when Cleveland proposed. Some say his feelings changed from guardian to suitor sometime while Frances was in college, and that he proposed then by letter. Others say that Frances and her mother were traveling after Frances graduated, and that Cleveland proposed when they made a stop through Washington, D.C. So regardless of timeline, however, it is pretty certain that this man, who was a little over 27 years her senior, was at least interested in Frances when she was pretty darn young. Now, while many young women married, of course, young, and most of them were married by their early 20s during this era, the fact that the Clevelands had such an age gap when they had already known each other all of their lives caused quite a few tongues to wag. We do know that right after Frances graduated from Wells College, she and her mother traveled through Europe, doing what many ladies had historically referred to as a grand tour. When she returned, Frances became the youongest first lady ever on June 2, 1886. The president was 49. Now you can only imagine how interested the nation would be in such a match. Yes, Grover Cleveland was the president, but Frances was quite the beauty, and certainly could have had her pick of men. Did she like the stability the man she had referred to as Uncle Cleve offered after the recklessness of her father and her mother's remarriage? We'll probably never know. More interestingly, the National Library's information on Frances Folsom said that Emma Folsom actually thought it should have been her that Cleveland was going to propose to. So what the really interesting wall to be a fly on would have been the one in the room where that conversation might have happened, where whomever it was that later reported this fact, you know, said Emma Folsom thought it was going to be her. I cannot even imagine the disappointment. However, I guess possibly I should say an elation at the same time. However, what we do know is that Frances handled all of the commotion surrounding the nuptials quite well, considering there really would be no handbook on how to handle the press, the politics, and the judgmental eyes of the Washington elite. The identity of the bride was actually kept secret until the week before the wedding, and the press tried all sorts of methods, including bribery, to get into the White House for the ceremony. So Grover Cleveland has proposed to Frances. You know, we're still not clear on the timeline of exactly when, if it was while she was still in college, which, of course, she still wouldn't have been at an age where it was unusual that she would have gotten engaged, just the fact that he was 28 years old, almost 28 years older than her, and that, you know, he'd known her since she was a baby. So they kept it a secret, and now they're all this time, all the way up until the ceremony, and I still can't figure out exactly why. if it was just to save Francis from the press or if it was because Grover Cleveland was worried about this, I don't know, and I guess we'll never know. The actual ceremony was held in the Blue Room, and the reception was attended by the Who's Who of Washington. Before this time, the president's sister Libby, also known by her given name Rose, had been carrying out the duties of First Lady. The resources I have seen suggest that she didn't mind giving up the job to Francis. Apparently, she went back to school after Francis moved in. I have to say, that really shows some sisterly love. So the couple took off after the ceremony to a resort that was still closed for the season called Deer Park in Maryland to spend their first night of marriage. A chase train followed their train, and a throng of reporters were on the grounds of the resort the next morning. So much for a bit of privacy, eh? The president's private secretary, Dan Lamont, and the wife of the Navy secretary, who was a well-known socialite, Flora Whitney, took Frances under their wings to coach her into a lady who was ready for all of that notoriety. However, Frances was already well on her way to being loved as the train pulled away for her honeymoon. Supposedly, there was a woman on the platform who was ill, and Frances leapt from the train to embrace the woman, showing great caring for the people of the nation. This, as well as her ladylike charm during her first reception back after the honeymoon, sealed the deal. The people and the press loved her. If she wore it, the fashion stuck. She had her own fashion, and that was a bit younger and flashier than some of the women in the Christian Temperance Union liked. But she stuck with her style. Funny enough, their Hope and Help project was one of the causes she championed, so they must have been willing to forgive her fashion forward sense. She had receptions on Saturday so that working women could attend. She smiled for the camera, which was totally unheard of at the time. She paid attention to her guests and their interests and tried to learn about the guests at the many White House dinner parties. So the real defiance of convention came when Frances said in her vows, instead of love, honor, and obey, she said love, honor, and keep, which I really like. Two reporters wrote that she no longer liked bustles on her dresses, and immediately bustles were considered out of fashion. Her picture was used to sell products, which often annoyed her, but the one that really got under her skin was the cosmetic laced with arsenic, in an era when people were beginning to understand the danger of using products with these type of harmful ingredients. But protesting on her part was useless. Frances's star power was far too great to keep under control. It was much more effective for her to use those powers for good when she could. So she played with the children at the, and please know that I'm just repeating these names, at the Colored Orphans Christmas Party, and one of her well-known causes was the Home for Friendless Colored Girls. She really stepped out of the protected world of First Lady to identify some real needs around Washington. So in 1887, when the president went on a tour for the southern and western U.S., Frankie, now as much as the press referred to her, even though she really hated that name, so she was Frank when she was little, she changed that to Frances, and now the press has called her Frankie. In today's media climate, there are always haters, no matter how hard someone tries. But the history's hottie was definitely getting more love than hate during this time. The people just loved her more after the tour than before. She was on magazine covers. She had the Jennifer Aniston hairstyle of the day, and ladies all over were copying it. She sold undergarments, pill cases, candy, and funny enough, because it's seriously doubtful she would have smoked them, cigars and cigar boxes. But her face certainly could sell them. Advertisers weren't just using her face without permission. They were suggesting she use their products that were being marketed to ladies, like cosmetics and perfumes. I think the funniest product I saw her face on, beyond the cigars, was ceramic tile. So you have tile in your house with the First Lady's face, and when she leaves the White House, what then? And still, she stuck to her guns and, you know, kept working for good. She just ignored all the product placement. Frances supported young female musicians, encouraged higher education for women, and was given a position on the Board of Trustees for Wells College, where she graduated from. That was actually just the year after marrying the president. There were a couple of firsts that show great foresight from Frances as well. Before this time, if someone had acted as an assistant or a personal secretary for the First Lady, it had always been a family member. However, the Clevelands actually hired a young lady named Minnie Alexander to serve as Francis's social secretary. They actually paid Minnie's salary themselves, and Minnie and Francis created a form letter to answer the massive amount of mail that was received by this very popular First Lady. While this might seem a bit impersonal, I'm sure this is just the only way that Minnie could respond to every letter, considering the fact that Francis had such fame. And, you know, there certainly weren't computers, typewriters at the time. It was, you know, Minnie handwriting these letters. However, Francis did face some serious challenges during this time of being the it girl. Francis hadn't attended the inauguration, probably because they, you know, were still keeping the engagement a secret. And Wells College would not give her permission to miss class. You would think an inauguration, even if you just knew the president, could be parlayed into a learning experience, but I guess not so much at the time. So it apparently caused some gossip when she didn't attend, because, you know, they had been longtime family friends. I am guessing also because the nation was waiting to see who this secret fiancé was, so when no fiancé showed up, you know, you're going to have some gossip then too. But the real first public scandal surfaced when political opponents asserted that Francis was having an affair with a newspaper man named Henry Watterson after the pair went to the theater. The real tawdry claim was that the president beat both his wife and mother-in-law, though. Can't you just see the public statement, "I have never beaten my wife"? We all know how those types of press conferences come across. The believers and non-believers usually fall along all sorts of lines. Francis and her mother both came out to deny the accusations. I have to say, well, I think there probably would have probably been a lot more evidence to support claims of abuse. I don't think this claim is true, because considering the amount of servants and aides that would have been just ever present in the White House, Grover probably wouldn't have been able to get away with, you know, being abusive to his wife and mother-in-law. I think somebody would have squealed. So, however, I don't think that Grover was a supporter of letting his educated wife have some sort of real open opinion about policy. They seem to have been a happy couple, but he definitely didn't think women had any place in politics of the day, and that they should, this is a great quote, should not bother her head about political parties and public questions. Does anyone else hear the almost archaic reference to the Catherine Beecher tenets of the 1840s? Come on, Grover, get with the program. He was lucky. She adored him as a child. So while Frances did things like encouraging young women to aspire to an education and possibly a career, she made sure she covered her ears, lest she pick up some tidbit of information that she might actually have an educated opinion on. I guess it was sort of the biting her tongue of her time. So we get on to the end of the first term, and Cleveland is running for president again. Francis's name was actually mentioned in the Democratic National Convention, the first time ever a first lady was mentioned in the political sphere when considering the possible next president. Alas, Cleveland lost that election, and the Clevelands were forced to leave one of the two homes they had lived in as a married couple. Other than the White House, they had rented a home when it was not the quote-unquote season, meaning the social season, in Washington. During the time between terms, the Clevelands were working and preparing for another term to get back into the house Francis had actually asked the staff to take care of, because she said she would be back in 4 years. When the second term began in 1893, Francis's life had changed. She was featured quite a bit during the failed presidential campaign of 1888, but in 1892, she was not near the center. Also, their daughter Ruth, who died when she was 12, an urban legend said that she was the inspiration for the baby Ruth, though the claim has been debunked by many, but I digress, had been born by this time. Coming back into the White House, Frances was still very active and had now effectively transformed her husband from this bachelor who acknowledged an illegitimate child to a family man, from a man who was, you know, accused of abusing her, to one who just seemed like, you know, a pro-family, you know, pro-morals president. Funny enough, the Cleveland's daughter Esther was the first child to be born to a president in one of the White House bedrooms. So now we have two firsts. But the third is quite a triumph for the office of First Lady. Frances, quote-unquote, paid a call to the Queen Regent of Spain, which made her the first First Lady to call on a head of state. She also showed support for the Princess Kulani from Hawaii after U.S. business interests had interrupted the reign of the monarchy. The push did eventually fail, but after President Cleveland sent a U.S. minister to Hawaii to encourage the restoration. But it is interesting that the man who made it clear wives had no place giving political advice to their husbands apparently listened to his wife on an issue and followed through with an action by actually sending a U.S. minister to Hawaii to try to intercede. The power of the First Lady was even more apparent when death threats against the president increased in mass during the second term. There was an economic depression and unemployment increased. Many weren't happy with the president's response and clashes were expected. Frances increased her husband's security detail, which Cleveland was unaware of and therefore did not give permission for. This seemed quite interesting to me. I'm sure the lack of clarity on how security would have been governed at the time was part of the reason this happened, but it does show that she was not without influence. Also, interestingly, when the president was diagnosed with jaw cancer, while the necessary surgery was performed secretly at sea, Frances was at the center of a plan to keep the surgery a secret to avoid unrest across this nation that was already tense with any news that a president might be ailing. So as all parties must come to an end, after the second 4 years, the Clevelands leave the White House and return to private life. Frances had two sons after leaving the White House, making her the only First Lady to have children after her husband's presidency. So we've got lots of firsts out of her. We talked about Ruth dying at 12 years old of diphtheria, and 4 years after that, Grover Cleveland died. Frances was 44 at this point and still serving on the board of Wells College. She had turned down the presidency of the Daughters of the American Revolution and, interestingly enough, became the champion of the academic and manufacturer who became her second husband. He was a professor, actually. The couple was even given a dinner by Nellie Taft at the White House. So Frances had won the heart of the American president, but not all of her views after his death were popular and garnered the same support they had when she was the young bride and first lady. World War I had broken out, and Frances and her new husband, Thomas Preston, were members of a group called the National Security League, meant to be a nonpartisan group promoting national pride and war preparation by creating volunteer-type squadrons. When Frances was put in charge of both the Speaker's Bureau and the Committee on Patriotism, through education in this NSL, or National Security League, she deviated from their original intent to a more controversial view. Frances basically asserted that a more militant approach that promoted fear to promulgate the support of the average citizen was necessary to support the war effort. The quote from Frances that is used to show her malcontent with the lack of exhibition of support for the war effort speaks to her view of those average people she was seeking to influence. She believed Americans did not unite for defense because of a, quote, huge percentage of unassimilated population that cannot think or act together, end quote. Well, apparently that was a bridge too far for the NSL, and Frances resigned in 1919. I would also have loved to have been a fly on that wall in a meeting where a former First Lady was asked to resign a volunteer position. But we history lovers know that getting into World War I and as an entire population was, you know, it was a controversial topic at the time. So, however, the factoid about Frances that really shocked me, considering her great support of women's education, was her belief that women weren't really ready to vote, and that when women had been given the vote, they were not successful in politics, and that volunteer and charity work was a more suitable way for women to be involved in community development. She had previously, as the vice president of the New Jersey Association Opposed to Women's Suffrage, she had served in that organization, and that was really surprising to me when I was doing my research. True to her beliefs, Frances Folsom Preston now was active in groups like the World War I era Needlework Guild. which made very necessary clothing and bedding during the war, and the Campfire Girls. Another really fascinating tidbit about Frances was how she handled news that later turned out to be untrue, that she was going to go blind. In preparation for what she thought was going to be her new reality, Frances learned Braille and to translate on a Braille typewriter. When it became clear she would not, in fact, go blind, she continued to type texts for a blind Navajo Indian teacher. So her skills were definitely not wasted. She made occasional appearances at public events with other presidents and first ladies and stayed active in her local community as well. Frances died in 1947 and completed the last of her first. She is the first lady with the longest period of time in her life spent after she was first lady, like we said earlier. Now, this doesn't seem like such an odd first since she was only 21 when she became first lady. However, it does give us a longer list of precedents. And that concludes the story of our history's hotties for the day. From a young, beautiful college student to it girl to influential wife to mother and then community activities, Frances stole the heart of a president and became the icon of how to marry an American president. Thank you, Frances, for making your controversies a little less Kardashian and a little more well-intentioned, if sometimes misguided. And thank you for reaching celebrity but still being yourself. If you have any questions, comments, or snide remarks, just email me at historieshotties@yahoo.com. That's HISTORYSHOTTIES at yahoo.com to forget the apostrophe, or visit our Facebook page. So until next time.